What's up, Capital Raisers? Joel Friedland is my spiritual brother from another mother. Have you heard that industrial syndications are on fire and a great place to put your money? We dive into why that is the case and how you get into the business in the first place. Joel hit a home run on some things that he does to raise capital that you can implement into any syndication business. Are you guys ready to raise? If you'd like to explore partnerships with me, Talk Shop on capital raising, or hire me as a coach, use the scheduling link in the show notes. With that, it's Capital Raisers Show, episode 264, and it starts now. Rock and roll, I got Joel Friedland on the Capital Raisers Show, my new friend and also listener to Wayne Dyer and his stuff. So hopefully we can talk a little bit about that. Welcome to the show, man. How you doing?
Hey, Ruben, doing great. I have been waiting so long to talk to you. I'm really glad we're doing this.
Yeah. So it kind of weirded me out a little bit because you're like, hey, I listen to you. I know you. I'm just like, well, hold on. We've never talked before. How is this possible? Well, I guess it's because I have a show and some people actually listen to it. So I love it when people tell me, hey, I love your spiritual perspective. I'm glad to hear that some people actually enjoy Wayne Dyer and some of the other things that we talk about here.
Yeah, I love Wayne Dyer. The whole concept of spirituality is a big part of my life. It doesn't necessarily have to be religion. No. Spirituality, I think, has a lot more to do for me with emotional health and how you feel about other people and being a giver and being someone who forgives and doesn't carry baggage in terms of things like grudges.
Yes. Yeah, forgiveness. When people hurt you, you can potentially harbor resentment against them. And the only person that hurts is you.
Exactly. But the other person doesn't even know necessarily that you're thinking about them. I call that being a free passenger on the train in your head. That's person is a free passenger and you're thinking of them and they don't even give a crap because they don't even know it, that you're doing that. And all it's doing is giving you a loop, sort of like a tape in your head, that you're negative, 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 and that negative energy really hurts you.
Yeah, fantastic. Okay, cool. Capital Raiser Show Season 3 brought to you by our friends at PitchDecks.com, Richard Wilson's company. So for the people that don't know about you, this is going to be fun because you're in industrial syndication. Tell us a little bit about your background, how you got into this business and into capital raising and stuff like that.
Sure. I went to the University of Michigan and I graduated in 1981 in one of the worst recessions that's ever hit the United States. Interest rates were about 17% when I graduated and I was looking for a job. And a friend of mine told me that there was this man in Chicago where I live who was looking to hire a property manager in the industrial real estate business. That the guy owned 84 industrial buildings and had hundreds of tenants. And he was struggling because he had vacancies during that recession and because he needed a property manager who he could trust. So I called this guy, I cold called him on the phone and I said, his name was Milton Podolsky. And I called him, I said, hey, Milt, friend of mine, Mark, told me to call you. He met you in a jacuzzi at your club. He said, you're in the industrial real estate business. I know nothing about it and I'm looking for a job. He said, hey, kid, you want to come in today and I'll interview you. So literally that day I got in my car, I drove to his office over near O'Hare Airport and I walked into his office and he was sitting there with his son. Milt at the time was 63, which is interesting because that's exactly how old I am today. Hmm. And he was sitting with his son who was in his early 30s and they interviewed me. And by the time the interview was over, they decided I wasn't going to go into property management, that I should go into sales. And the reason they thought that was because I, as a kid, starting at age 14, went door to door, getting neighbors to agree to let me to do landscaping at their house. Brilliant. And I got 70 lawns door to door canvassing at age 14 and hired a bunch of my friends. When other people were playing basketball and football, I was running a business when I was in junior high school and middle school. And Milt heard that. He said, can you go door to door and industrial parks and find tenants for our vacant buildings that are costing me thousands of dollars a day? I said, yeah, sure, of course. He said, do you take no for an answer? I said, never, ever. I was so cocky. I was 22. I was the cockiest guy. I learned a lot. It's bad to be cocky, but I was cocky then. And I went door to door and I filled up all of his buildings in the first year. I made 37 industrial leases.
Wow.
Yeah.
At 22 yeah. years old, that's good.
It was crazy. I was on a natural high. I went home and I told my parents, I was living at home. I said, I've leased all these buildings. And my mother said, how did you learn how to do this? I said, I don't know. I went to the neighborhoods and I went door to door. I got kicked out of so many places going door to door canvassing. The best story, you want a great one?
Yeah, let's go.
I go into this industrial space. It's an industrial building. And I had a line. So I said to this guy sitting behind a desk, a young guy, I said, hey, you want to move out of this dump into the building next door that I have available for lease? And he said, you think it's a dump? I said, I was just kidding. Dad just was using that as a term. He said, I'll be right back. So he comes back with an old man with a walker and another guy his age. And he says, this is my dad and he owns this dump. And this is my brother. And we're pretty pissed off that you're trying to take us out of a building that we own and that you called it a dump. And the old man said, take him out. So one brother takes me under the right underarm and the other one takes me under the left. And they pick me up. They push the door open of their front door and they carry me to the parking lot and threw me down on the parking lot where I ripped my pants.
Oh,
it was lucky that I didn't break my head open. And I called Milt and I said, hey, I just got thrown out and I ripped my pants. He said, kid, you're doing the job I want you to. I'll buy you a new pair of pants. It was fantastic. I'll never forget it. At the time, I was scared to death. I thought they were going to kill me.
Different times. Wow.
Yeah.
Very cool. All right. So you started as a leasing agent. I think you created your own brokerage too. What did you do in the brokerage? You sold industrial buildings or what kind of brokerage was it?
Yeah. So I went to work for this family, the Podowski family. Steve Podowski and this other fellow, Richard, taught me the business. They taught me all about leases and selling industrial and how industrial works. And I worked for them for 10 years. And the Podowski family, it was a father, the son Steve, another son, and a daughter. And I wanted to be a partner in a business. I didn't want to be an employee. And I asked them if they would adopt me, and they said no. So I ended up starting my own business with three other people who were in the industry that did not work for my company. And we became brokers and developers. We started right away. I saw that Milt made all of his money not by being an agent, but by being a syndicator who raised money from investors and bought industrial buildings and owned them long term.
When was this?
This was in 1991. It was 10 years after I started working for him.
Okay, cool.
And I went to Milt and I said, I want to learn how to be a syndicator and how to develop. And he said, I'll be your first investor.
And how to develop? You mean like ground up construction?
Ground up. My first deal was a ground up development. I had never done anything like this before. And I went and I found a contractor who was also an architect. And we found a piece of land. And I went out and I raised dollar increments of $20,000 per investor from family and friends and clients of my brokerage business. And Milt put in 10% of the money. And we built the first building and we leased it to a company that made and distributed building products, like not wood, but different kinds of tools and drywall and that kind of thing. And we went and did our second one. And the second one was five times bigger. The first one was about $600,000, all cash, no mortgage. And the second project was about $3 million, all cash, no mortgage. And Milt and his family invested in that. So I went to work for these people 41 years ago. And the son, Steve Podowski, is still an investor with me in my most recent syndication. And I just had lunch with him in Florida.
Okay,
so I'm a believer in long-term relationships.
Yeah.
Take care of your friends. Take care of your investors. Take care of your tenants. If you're good to them, they'll be good to you. It comes back to you 10 times, in my opinion, when you're good to people.
So you developed this philosophy, or I should say you acquired it or adopted it from the people that you were working with back then, which is to pay all cash in a syndication versus using any equity or mortgage. Is this correct? You got that
well,
model
for somebody else? It's correct to a point. I'll tell you, I went wrong. I went bad. I made some gigantic mistakes. What happened was my first two deals were all cash. And then I got a new partner who was 10 years younger than I was. He was the football hero in his high school. He was the quarterback. He went to Northwestern on a full football scholarship, and he was a tough, smart, capable guy. And he said, hey, let's do another deal, but let's borrow some money. We can go to the bank. And so we did that, and the deal worked. And then we did another one, and we went to the bank, and we borrowed more. You know the story about the frog? You put it in cold water on the stove, and then you turn the heat up, and eventually the frog boils to death, but he doesn't know he's about to boil to death because it happens slowly over a period of minutes. Well, what happened was I became a regular real estate guy who borrowed money from banks. I ended up having, I've done 95 property acquisitions, probably $350 million worth with $100 million of equity. And in the middle of all that, I was borrowing like everybody else. And in 2008, what happened was there was a recession like no one's ever seen before. And I had seven banks. I had borrowed money from 62 individuals, and I had guarantees on 112 separate loans. And everything went to crap, including me. So it was awful.
So I've heard that the people that were in multifamily during that recession were cash flowing and survived because of that. Now, with the industrial properties, they're based off of, just like any other commercial real estate property, on the net operating income. So what happened? Did the values of the properties go down during the 2008 crash or not? Or tell me about that.
Well, they did a little bit, just like everything did, including multifamily. Everything went down a little bit. But industrial's tricky. It's more complicated because industrial isn't like where you have a multifamily 200 unit building or complex. It's more, in our case, one tenant or two tenants or three tenants per building. They're called single tenant net leased. So we'll lease a building to a company for 7 years, but when that lease comes up, if they leave, it's 100% vacant.
Yes, that's true.
So what happened during that terrible time in 2008 to people like us is we suffered from a series of vacancies all at the same time, when tenants either went bankrupt or stopped paying rent and we had to evict them, or their leases came up and they tried to save money by cutting back. That's what happened. And I went into a severe emotional depression.
I bet.
I know if someone's listening, they can't see it, but you see that couch behind me here on the screen? Yeah. I was on that couch and I couldn't get off. And I was so depressed that literally I was thinking thoughts like, oh my God, I don't want to live. I don't want to live through this. I've lost everybody's money. Everyone who's trusted me, I've let them down. And I went through a really, really rough period. And I fought through it and I dealt with the banks and I made forbearance agreements where they allowed me to pay less for a little while and catch up later. And I made deals with people and a bunch of miracles happened and we survived it. And most of the investors were happy to see that I really supported their investments and them by working hard to bring it back. And that's when I decided that debt for me, I'm not saying this for everybody, but debt for me is not tolerable with who I am. So I started syndicating and raising money from people and saying to them, I am not going to borrow any money. If you come in with into my deal, you're going to make a lower return because it's not leveraged. But if you're interested in not losing your money, because there is no bank that's ever going to foreclose and banks don't have a sense of humor, I'm probably the only person you'll ever invest with who has that attitude in real estate. But it's a line in the sand for me that I only do all cash deals, no mortgages, period.
Capital preservation is a real thing, actually. So, I mean, particularly with family offices, they're more interested in making sure that they keep the money instead of making returns on it. Not all family offices, of course, everybody's got a different philosophy, but I see that as a common theme amongst a lot of high net worth individuals, and particularly second and third generations of families that have acquired generational and inherited wealth. Their main objective is to not lose it, because they say the first generation makes the money, the second maintains it, and the third loses it. So that's a lot of stress. If you're the third generation, you haven't learned the business, just figure out a way to make sure and not lose it. I can see those people wanting to invest in something like that for sure.
For anyone who's listening to this who is younger, I'm at age 63, I've learned a lot of lessons. And one of those lessons is people who trust me stay with me, and people who don't trust me leave. And they don't call and say, hey, I don't trust you, so I'm never going to invest with you again. If someone doesn't invest with me again, they don't call me and give me an exit interview. They just disappear. They walk with their feet. I'm very lucky. I have investors who've been with me for 30 years, 20 years, the newest investors who've been with me for just a short period of time. I intend, if I live as long as my mentor, who's 95 years old and still active.
Awesome.
That means I still have 32 years if I happen to be as lucky as he is to live that long in a healthy way. I want these people to be with me that long. I'm not looking to make a quick buck and move on to the next people. Burning bridges is something that I used to do. I used to dynamite bridges at times when I was younger. I was much more aggressive. And you and I are talking about reading Wayne Dyer. Life is too short to do things that don't make us better people. So I try.
Young
very
people don't hard. Realize that, though.
No.
I don't talk about my background too much from when I was a kid, but my father died when I was 7 and I didn't have any father figure. I was very angry for a long time at the entire world. And then somewhere down the road, I was like, oh, I need to change my circle of influence. And I got into personal development and Wayne Dyer and stuff. But a lot of people don't know when they're younger that you can live a certain way to attract certain things to your life. We're just very aggressive because we're dumb, you know, ignorant and kids. So I get it. I think a lot of people, they need to be forgiven for that and forgive themselves for that and just get on with life and continue to advance.
Yeah, I mentor a lot of people. I'm currently mentoring 6 real estate people who are of various ages and various levels of experience. And I talk to them, on average, I talk to at least 3 of them a week. And we do a lot of trading back and forth of emails and texts. And one of the things that I've learned is that people who are newer need guidance. If you try to do it by yourself, you might do great, but you might not. And someone who's got a great mentor is likely to do very well. I believe that if I went to the worst neighborhood in Chicago and picked some 18-year-old young person and said, I'm going to mentor you in real estate, you could look at a family and say, like, there's 3 brothers that are all living under one roof and I'm mentoring the one. That one's going to become a millionaire and is going to be a successful real estate person if he's got any talent at all. I don't know what's going to happen to the other ones, but it's all mentorship. It's who it is that takes you under their wing to teach you how to do it. And I've had these great mentors, and many of my mentors are my biggest investors. And when I'm a mentor, many of my mentees are my biggest investors. Mm. So I think it's about sharing values more than anything. It's sharing values more than it's sharing knowledge.
I love that. All right, so let's continue to explore this cash-only syndication. So we talked about capital preservation. After the real estate crash, man, I don't know if we should bring up cycles or if we should talk about the cash syndication. I'll give you the choice.
Let's talk about the cash syndication. First of all, I think we're at the top of a cycle right now. I think there's going to be a bubble pop pretty soon. I don't know when. It could be this year, next year, the year after. But people need to be prepared and understand that you need to be able to handle what goes wrong so that you don't lose it. And so you're not too far out over your skis. And my philosophy of all cash is just that. It's to make sure that if something really bad happens, that I can handle it. Industrial is interesting. One of the things you need to know about industrial, it's really hard to get into because to get in, someone needs to more or less sponsor you or you're not taken seriously by the players in the industry.
I can see that.
So I was lucky that I had this Podolsky family to sponsor me. I hit it off with them and I met other people in the industry. Industrial's great and it's also terrible. What's great about it is the returns are better. If you look at some of your ideal multifamily, at one point in the recent past when interest rates were low, I think your cap rates were probably in the 5s.
Depending on the market. Yeah, they were in the 4s, 5s.
Okay. I couldn't look at a 4 in industrial with a straight face. I don't do a deal unless it's an 8. So industrial, the return can be twice as good. So an all cash deal, I can give somebody a yield, which is cash flow every year, quarterly, 2% a quarter sent by ACH to their bank account, 8% a year, increasing every year with annual escalations. But we could hit this wall and just be dead when the tenant leaves, because if we can't refill the building with a new tenant, we've got taxes, insurance, maintenance, and utilities that hit us every single month, and no money coming in. So even with no mortgage, there's still expenses and you have to survive it, which means we have to have a lot of cash reserves in the bank in addition to not having a mortgage in order to get through the tough times. So all my friends in multifamily, I admire them and I like hearing their stories. I've got about 15 or 20 friends who are extremely wealthy, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of multifamily all over the country, some in Chicago where we live. I'm different. I've got a different way of doing things. They don't understand my business that well, but the raising money is the same. It's the same people, because most of the people who invest with me are in syndications with these other folks. And it's just a matter of explaining the difference and the risk and the reward for my kind of real estate. But when I tell them it's all cash, no mortgage, if they have a family office or they're worth $100 million as a person, they love my stuff and they like what I do, because I've got the track record for 40 years. And I tell them preservation of your capital is the most important thing to me, because I literally went into a depression when I felt I might have lost people's money, and I'm just planning not to do that. And it's all the same thing. Then after that, it's building the relationship. And I don't let anybody in unless I get to know them and trust them, because I have more money than I need for syndication. I'm looking for the right investors. I'm not looking for just any investors. Mm-hmm. And that's really important. Yeah. So if someone was to send me money, like without meeting me, I would not accept it. The minimum time I want to spend getting to know someone who's going to invest with me is at least a half an hour on the phone. And if I don't know everything about them, it's not working. I need to know where they're from, what business they were in or are in, how many kids they have, what their goals are.
That's the key right there. So yeah, it's really exploring the person and what their needs are and what their emotional triggers are and determining their pain points and helping them invest for their own reasons. There's a couple of things I want to chat about that I'm curious about. Like one thing you mentioned is the low caps and multifamily. I'm not sure if that really accounts for forcing of appreciation, because there's big equity plays, or at least there has been over the last 10 years in multifamily. So I was going to ask you about, how do you force appreciation, you know, in industrial?
So industrial has been on fire in terms of how good it is. And the reason is because e-commerce has taken a lot of business away from brick and mortar retail stores. And every time you see a chain like a Macy's or Bed Bath & Beyond, whenever these kind of people get in trouble, they get replaced not by another store at a different location. They get replaced by an Amazon or a Wayfair or a Target from their industrial warehouse building where people order online. So the online business has created this huge boom in industrial. And anyone who's institutional, if you call and say, what is the best area of real estate to get into today? You call institutions, you call pension funds, developers, every one of them says, of course, industrial. And it's because it's outrageously good. That's why I think it's going to pop. It's been too good for too long. And what I do is I buy these smaller industrial buildings that I syndicate that are not appealing to the big institutions. And most of our tenants are manufacturers and distributors, family owned or local branches of international or national companies.
And what markets do you purchase these syndications or acquire these syndications?
We're hyper-focused Chicago only. We know the market like the back of our hand. If someone landed in a helicopter in Chicago and stayed here for 2 years and knocked on every door of every industrial building, it would take them another 3 years to catch up to what we know about it. So it's years of learning the people and the buildings. And if I went to some other market like Tampa or I went to Austin, someone else would eat my lunch that knows that market well. And so it's the market knowledge in our due diligence where when we look at a property, we really examine it closely. We pay for inspections and we hire lawyers to check the title. We do so much investigative work, due diligence. It's just super hyper focus.
being in the same market, have you bought and acquired some of the same buildings over and over?
Yeah, it's a funny one. We built a building in 1997, 14,000 square feet at 209 Ambrosio Drive in Gurnee, Illinois. I built it. I developed it, leased it, and the tenant bought it from us. And one of the young guys in our office was making cold calls in 2019, about 4 years ago, and called the guy that we had sold the building to. And let me imitate him. He answers the phone. He goes, hello? And the guy says, hello? And he says, yeah, what do you need? And my guy asked him a few questions. He says, well, I'm 100 years old, and I bought the building 20 years ago, and now I'm going to leave the business to my young son. And the guy said, how old's your young son? He's 80. So
that's fantastic.
Because I want to sell the building and lease it back because we don't want to own it anymore. So the young guy didn't know that we built and owned the building and sold it to this guy. We went and met with him and he said, oh, it's you. And we bought the building back from him.
And then leased it to him.
And leased it to him.
That's yeah. Cool.
It's hysterical.
Okay. So I'm also curious about, so you mentioned in your early days, you were very good as a leasing agent, which I believe has got to be a major part of the business model. If you only have one tenant, you can pick up distressed syndications, and then you're probably, hopefully, wanting to be a better leasing agent and get a responsible or good tenant in there at a higher clip and higher percentage rate, or better ability to find a good tenant than the existing manager who's selling the property. Is this one of the major parts of your business?
It is. It's the major part. When people ask me the three rules of real estate, I actually have two sets of three rules. The first three rules are no vacancy, no vacancy, no vacancy. And the second three rules, believe it or not, are parking, parking, and parking. Mm. Because most buildings, when they were built, were underparked. And when companies grow, they have nowhere to put their cars and everybody drives to work.
I bet.
So it's leasing. I've got to be able to lease them up. And we have 300 industrial real estate brokers in Chicago. We all know each other. And I hire other agents who know an area intimately to be the agent for us to lease them or sell them. It's a fascinating thing. We don't sell for cap rates. We don't believe in that. We sell single tenant buildings to users, which means to a neighbor or someone else who's in manufacturing or distribution. And it's a tool for their business. Unlike with apartments, you can't lease to somebody who's going to go in there and buy the whole place. That's not how it works. But in our business, we find someone who may not want to lease. They want to buy and they have to buy a building. And so when we have a vacancy, we have two choices. Do we lease it and keep it, or do we sell it? And we take what comes first.
Hmm.
And very often, the first thing that happens is the next door neighbor shows up and says, I must have this building because I have 80 machines that are bolted to the ground, and to move them would cost me $3 million. So how much do you want for your building? And this is called the user sale strategy. And what I say is that it's the punch in the face theory. If somebody wants your building because it's the perfect tool for their business, I tell my mentees, you literally could punch them in the face while they're there. And they'll say, thanks for the punch. Now, how much do I have to pay to buy this? And that's how it works. The user theory. So it's very different because it's not a cap rate sale. And a user will pay a premium, a big premium.
Very interesting business model.
Yeah.
Sounds really cool. Before we go into the lightning round, I'm curious about the raising capital. You can use the same strategies amongst multiple industries, but let's find out what your strategy is. Is it a lot of relationship building? Do you do any marketing whatsoever? Do you deal with a lot of smaller limited partners or larger investors? Who's your avatar?
It's a minimum investment in our deals of $25,000 to be a partner with us. Very few people go in for that little, and I discourage them from putting more in than 1% of their total net worth. I tell them that I believe diversification is the most important thing. That's a good way to start a conversation. So I say to somebody, if your personal net worth is $3 million, you shouldn't put more than $30,000 into any one of my syndications. And people look at me and they say, well, wait a minute, what if I want to put in more? I said, well, the most you should ever put in is 3%. So if your net worth is 3 million, put 90 or 100,000 in. That's as much as you should do in any one single deal. Once I've said that, the relationship is solidified because it sounds like I know what I'm talking about. The second thing that I do is I go into negativity and I say, I'd like to show you my track record. And before we start, I'm going to tell you that out of 95 properties, we've sold 70 of the properties, and I've had 7 major losses where people lost money and it was a disaster.
Yeah, transparency is amazing.
Yeah, when I start with negative, it usually gets positive. If you start with positive, it usually gets negative.
People will try and mismatch you. So if you go negative, they'll try and find the positive in it, which is going to be, hey, this person's going to be truthful, transparent. I can trust him. He's probably learned from his mistakes. I like his honesty. It makes complete sense.
Yeah. And then the last thing I do is I say, I want you to do me a favor before you consider investing. I want to get to know you better. But after I get to know you better, I want to know everything that you can tell me about you. Because if you die, I want to know who your wife is, because she's going to call me. And I want to know who your kids are, because they're going to call me. Because I've been doing this a long time, and that does happen. And I think that that's really important, that we get to know each other extremely well. But I also have one other thing that I do. I say to them, there's an issue that I have with you investing with me, and I want you to be aware of it. We hold long-term. And if you're not a long-term holder, you're not a fit for us. We might sell something in a year and make a big profit, but I said, I have a building we've owned for 30 years. And if you're not okay with being a long-term investor with me, you need to go talk to somebody else. I don't really want to tell them how quickly they're going to make a lot of money, because when cycles happen and things change, it may not be the best time to sell.
I want to hear about this because you mentioned earlier before we got into the show that one of the ways that you keep these buildings long-term is you let people buy in and out of the deals. So some of your LPs, if they want to be out after 15 years, or if they have an emergency where they have to pay for something or buy a house or put their kids or grandkids through college or something like that, or a wedding comes up or whatever, you let them sell off their shares to other people. Is this common? Not common? Tell me about this.
I've never heard of anybody else who does it, but it happens that we're the long-term keeper guys. So we need something to give people liquidity so that they don't feel like they're stuck forever. And so we create an annual report for each property, what I call the high value and the low value, what I think it's worth, and then back up as to why I believe that the value is what it is. And if somebody wants to get out of a deal, I say to them, tell me when you want to get out, and I'll introduce you to one of the 7 or 10 people who are saying to me that if someone ever wants out, introduce me and I'll make them an offer. I give the same analysis to the buyer of the syndicated piece, to the buyer and to the seller. And each one looks at it and each one can ask me questions and get very familiar with what they think it should be worth and what the yield would be if they trade it. If the buyer says, I want to get an 8% yield, then it's a certain price. And then I let them talk to each other without me on the phone. And the buyer makes an offer and the seller either accepts or he doesn't. And that happens about 5 or 6 times a year. And it's great for liquidity. It helps me because if I have no offerings at the moment, it gives me something to bring a new investor into. So, and the new investor then gets the benefit of a really stable long-term investment with a good return.
Very interesting business. I hope you guys are getting some value from this. I don't think that I've ever interviewed somebody exclusively, at least on the show. I've talked to them offline, but on the show, this is a very cool asset and niche of commercial real estate that we've been able to explore. So hopefully you guys like that. Let's jump into the lightning round. How about I start with this question, which is the same as I always start with. Best vacation you've ever taken?
Costa Rica.
Where did you go?
We went all over Manuel Antonio, and we had a little island that we went to where there were only 8 rooms, and our family had 2 of the 8 rooms. Our kids and my wife and I had 2 rooms.
Were you on the East Coast or the West Coast?
Both. We did both. We had to take a little flight. I hate those little planes. We took a little puddle jumper to the island, and we were sitting on the beach, and we had food in a backpack, and we were sort of resting, and a monkey came and stole our food.
Yeah. There's a lot of monkeys in Costa Rica, guys.
Yeah.
Very cool. Favorite book of any kind?
I love biographies. I love biographies. You learn a lot about people when you read their life story. And there's a book about Steve Jobs by a guy named Walter Isaacson, which was so outstanding. I just loved it. And then Howard Schultz, who was the founder and the guy who started and ran and still runs Starbucks, had a book about all of his struggles when he first started, when he just had one store and he was almost out of business a bunch of times. I love those bios. They're great.
Okay. And then I also saw you lift up a Wayne Dyer, Change Your Thoughts, Change Your Life book that I just got. So I'm really excited to dive into that. Wanted to give Dr. Wayne Dyer a shout out because he's my superhero and my mentor. Next question I have for you is, do you have any hacks for breaking through limiting beliefs?
I do.
How do you break them? How do you deal with them?
I do a lot of journaling. I believe in journaling. And I call people who I think are spiritually more self-aware, I would say. I've got some friends. I have some friends in some 12-step programs. I find that people who have overcome alcoholism and drugs and things like that who are in these programs and are sober long-term are some of the most incredible people. And I have some friends, and the best guidance I get is from my 12-steppers.
Interesting. Very cool. How long do you want to live?
Well, I'll tell you that my mentor, Nate, is 95 years old. And up until last year, he told me that he's still looking for new deals. Other people will tell you at that age, I'm not looking to buy any green bananas, which is a funny statement. Nate's optimistic. He buys green bananas. So I like the idea. I would love to match Nate. I hope he makes it to over 100. He's one of those people I call for advice. He's one of my great mentors.
That's fantastic. All right, can you tell me about a moment that changed the trajectory of your life?
Yeah, I had a very serious illness in 2008. I was diagnosed with a heart defect. And up until that time, I was a hypochondriac. You know, I'd get sick and I'd be a baby, and my wife would say, "You baby, get out of bed. You don't have to be in bed for a cold." And, you know, every little symptom was a heart attack. And what I realized was I needed to get out of myself. I was so focused on every little thing. And I decided after that, I went through a lot of medical testing, and it turned out to be fortunately nothing serious, even though for several months, it was a lot of hospital testing. And I changed. I became more spiritual. I became a forgiver. I became more of a person who wants to give more than I take. And that was it. That was pivotal.
And this happened in 2008 while you were on the couch, freaking
Same
out
time.
In a fetal position.
Yeah, what I was on my way to the Cleveland Clinic in an airplane with my mother-in-law and my wife to get tested. And this was when all my deals were going bad and I was depressed. And I was kind of hoping, except that it would kill everybody else, that the plane would crash and put me out of my misery. It was a rough time.
They happen. We can get through them, guys. Stay positive. All right. Best way to raise capital from your perspective. Short answer on this.
Relationships with people who trust you.
What do you love about being a grandfather and building forts with your grandkids?
I know you. I've got a 4-year-old and a 1-year-old granddaughter and a baby boy on the way in April. And my granddaughter, who's 4, came over. I taught her how to play air hockey. And at first she couldn't get the puck to go all the way across the entire thing. It went to the middle. And by the end, she was scoring goals and banking the puck off the side. And then when we were done, we took the air hockey table and we made a fort out of it. And we sat in the fort, which was made out of blankets and sheets, and played inside. And it was great. It was just great.
That's amazing, man. I can't wait to have kids. That's going to be a lot of fun. Do your spiritual philosophies have anything to do with your success in business?
100%.
So yeah. I know that we resonate here. Tell me a little bit more.
It's not necessarily about being religious.
No.
It's about the universe having your back. The universe, yes. I believe, has your back.
It does.
There's a woman
on your behalf.
Yeah, there's a woman named Gabby Bernstein who is fantastic. And she talks about, she has a book called The Universe Has Your Back. And she does a lot of meditating. And she's a big fan of our buddy Wayne Dyer. And I just love what she does. And I also love listening to Joel Osteen. I think he's very uplifting. And even though there's a religious element to it, which I also like, I think he's fantastic. He talks about forgiveness and moving on and not letting the little things get you and being good to people. It's great.
Good stuff. I'll have to check them out. Have you ever experienced a miracle or had a near-death experience?
Miracles, yes. I think that people don't realize that little miracles can happen to you every day if you look for them. And when I journal, I have something called a gratefulness journal, and I've got about 150 things on that gratefulness list. Every one of them's a miracle. Everyone. I've got 150 miracles on a list, and all I have to do is look at it and pick one or two or three of them in any given day, and I feel pretty good.
Yeah, life itself is a miracle, so I love that. All right, last question brought to you by Shanna Amigo, one of our great listeners. She would like to know, what impact would you like to leave in the world?
I think being a mentor and helping people grow. That's really it.
That's fantastic. Very cool. Thanks for entertaining us on that part of the show. Shout out to the Capital Razor Nation. Thanks for tuning in. Please leave us a 5-star written review. Shout out to Legacy Acquisitions and our sponsors, Syndication Pro, the Family Office Club, and PitchDecks.com. Check out their offers at CapitalRazorShow.com. Joel, how does the audience get a hold of you, my friend?
BritProperties.com. That's our website, BRITProperties.com. We have property management, and Brit stands for one of our property managers. We named it after him. Brad really is terrific.
Okay, cool. And then do you have any last words of wisdom for the aspiring capital raiser or somebody who's looking to get mentored into syndication, which regardless of asset class?
Yes. Call people every day and check in with them and be curious about them and ask questions about them every day. If you are a capital raiser, you have to talk to 3 people minimum a day, in my view, whether they're investors or someone who can introduce you to one. These are the people who make a difference in your life, and 15 a week and 60 a month. And if you miss a day, you miss another day, and then you miss another day, and 60 a month turns into 0 a month. So 3 a day.
Cool. I want to piggyback on that, because a lot of times people, when they're looking for a mentor or somebody that they can partner with, a lot of times they ask, like, how can I be of service to you? And I would invite you to, instead of asking that question, ask them, what is preventing you from 10Xing your business? And then they'll tell you the things that they need to grow, which will give you the opportunity to say, oh, I can do that. And that is the way that you get in where you fit in. Keep that in mind when you're talking to people, because people don't have the bandwidth to tell you exactly what skill you have and then dissect you and then tell you where you fit into their business. They don't have the time or even understanding of who you are and what skills you have. So instead, don't let them try and find those skills in you. You ask them what they need, and then you can basically let them know this is where you can help them. So that would be my recommendation to you.
I'd like to add one thing. The words are interested is interesting. People think that you're interesting if you are interested in them.
That's great. That's good. I don't think I've ever heard that. I mean, I've heard it, but not on the show. So that's,
I'll give credit to Dale Carnegie. That's Dale Carnegie.
Good stuff. All right, cool, dude. This has been phenomenal, man. I'm so glad we got to meet and hang out and share different kind of like spiritual philosophies and also talk about a new industry. It's not new to most people, but to my audience, I don't know that we're all too familiar with it. So this has been great. I really appreciate you coming on, brother.
I've enjoyed it very much.
The Capital Razor Show.